Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jamal Abdi of the National Iranian American Council, who assesses the historic International Iran Nuclear Accord signed last week and the consequences if congressional opponents succeed in killing the agreement. Stephen F. Cohen, Professor Emeritus in Russian Studies and Politics at New York University in Princeton, who discusses the danger posed by the ongoing East-West proxy war in Ukraine and U.S.-Russian military escalation. And Wensler Nosey Sr., former San Carlos Apache tribal chairman, who talks about his tribe's campaign to reverse the government's giveaway of a sacred Native American site to mining conglomerate Rio Tinto. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
According to the Los Angeles Times, the U.S. Border Patrol's Internal Affairs Division absolved border agents of criminal misconduct in 67 shooting incidents, which left 19 people dead. Among the incidents were two separate cases of U.S. border agents killing Mexican teenagers who were throwing rocks across the border. The investigation, which was completed in May, absolved agents of criminal misconduct in all but three cases, which are still pending. The only disciplinary action taken by supervisors were oral reprimands given to two border agents. Immigrant advocates have long argued that the U.S. Border Patrol, whose numbers have swelled over the last two decades, face little accountability in cases of alleged abuse. Unlike local U.S. police departments, the 21,000-member Border Patrol rarely discloses any public information on agents involved in shootings or the outcome of internal investigations. Methamphetamine is the new hot drug in China, where it's locally known as Bingdu or ICE. Meth has quickly been transformed from a drug popular with the wealthy elite to one now widely used by the rural poor. Chinese authorities say the meth epidemic has now overtaken heroin as the illicit drug of choice. Hundreds of meth labs have sprung up across China, and many operate with little fear of being shut down by police. A recent report by China's Narcotic Control Commission identified over 13 million addicts, half of them hooked on meth, a number double the estimated number of meth addicts in the United States. According to the Christian Science Monitor, China has a long, troubled history with drug addiction. Millions of Chinese were addicted to opium in the 19th century after it was brought to the country by the British from India. At one point, 20% of Chinese men were hooked on opium, seen as a national humiliation at the hands of Western powers. After the 1949 Communist Revolution, illicit drug use quickly disappeared from Chinese life. But the drug trade returned after China opened up its economy in the 1980s. Dozens of Chinese chemical companies now sell designer drugs to Western customers on English language websites. When Hillary Rodham Clinton shut down her 2008 presidential drive, the campaign had 2.5 million email addresses in its database. When the former U.S. Senator and Secretary of State launched her 2016 campaign, her staff discovered only 100,000 email addresses were still active. This large attrition of active emails is not unique, reports the Los Angeles Times. Typically, an email list will lose 20% of subscribers a year. But the falloff of active email contacts has created logistical obstacles for Clinton as she builds her grassroots fundraising operation. In 2012, the Obama re-election campaign had 30 million email addresses at its peak and raised $485 million through constant online appeals, over 40% of the money raised by Obama overall. Earlier this year, the Clinton campaign hadn't yet set up its Facebook or Instagram accounts and had only 3 million followers on Twitter. In contrast, insurgent Democratic Party candidate Senator Bernie Sanders has surged on the internet, learning techniques developed by the Howard Dean campaign in 2004. Sanders' digital presence has helped his campaign raise $15 million from small donors in the first 3 months of 2015. Clinton, still the Democratic frontrunner, is now playing catch-up in the important competition for social media attention. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Iran, the United States, and permanent members of the UN Security Council, Britain, France, Russia, and China, along with Germany, signed a historic agreement in Vienna on July 14th that's designed to limit Iran's nuclear capabilities to peaceful civilian purposes. In exchange, the UN will over time lift economic sanctions, allowing the Islamic Republic to resume international trade and gain access to billions of dollars that had been frozen. The 15-member UN Security Council unanimously approved the accord on July 20th, as did the European Union. While U.S. President Barack Obama and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani applauded the breakthrough agreement, conservative, primarily Republican opponents of the nuclear deal vowed to gather enough votes in the U.S. Congress to win a resolution of disapproval and override a promised presidential veto of such a measure. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a longtime opponent of negotiations with Iran, has said he'll personally pressure U.S. lawmakers to derail the accord. The government of U.S. ally Saudi Arabia and leaders of the Gulf monarchies have also expressed grave concerns about the nuclear agreement. Your reporter spoke with Jamal Abdi, Action Executive Director with the National Iranian American Council, who discusses the significant accomplishments of the Iran nuclear agreement, and his view that the U.S. peace movement must now mobilize to prevent Congress from killing the Iran nuclear accord, an outcome that would likely lead to a new war.
So there's two lenses I would view the accord through. The first one is, of course, this technical lens, the non-proliferation lens. This is an arms control agreement. It is an agreement that puts certain constraints on Iran's nuclear program. It limits the type of nuclear work Iran can do. It puts inspections in place to verify that Iran is limited to purely peaceful purposes for its nuclear program. And it lifts sanctions in exchange. Generally, the technical side is viewed very favorably. There have been sort of this attempt to poke holes in the agreement by raising small technical issues. How fast can sanctions be slapped back in place if Iran violates? What type of access do the inspectors have, not just to nuclear facilities, but to military facilities? And things of that nature. But the bottom line is the deal, from my vantage point and from a lot of experts' vantage point, achieves the objective of ensuring Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon, and we can verify that. We know that because we have inspectors. And in exchange, sanctions get lifted on Iran. Not all the sanctions, but most of the sanctions. The other lens, though, that I view this through is the political lens. And the fact of the matter is, no matter how technically sound the deal is, building a nuclear weapon is a political decision for a country like Iran that has the capability to do so, that has the technological prowess to enrich. It's not a matter of simply putting technical restraints in place. It's also a matter of ensuring that the political decision is never made to actually build a nuclear weapon. It's also a political decision for the United States and Iran to, after 35 years of not talking to one another, of really working against one another and trying to contain and counter the influence of each country, that they have now decided to sign an agreement, to come to the table and actually use diplomacy to reach a common understanding, which could be a positive sign for things to come and possible areas where the two countries could actually stop working against one another and begin working together to resolve some of the real tricky questions in the region. And so on the political front, while I think that still a lot remains to be seen, compared to the technical side of things, there's far less certainty about what direction this potentially will take us. There's also a lot of opportunity there. And this is a major milestone towards potentially really changing the relationship and changing sort of the United States' role in the region and who we can talk to and who we can't talk to. So on both fronts, I think that's a really good deal. There are a lot of people who powerful special interest groups that are going to spend a lot of money to try to block the deal and oppose it because it upends the status quo in a lot of ways. But on its merits, technically, politically, it's a sound deal, and hopefully it will be allowed to move forward so it can we can reap the benefits of it.
Jamal, most congressional Republicans and some Democrats, the Saudis, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, assert that the accord will guarantee that Iran will eventually build a nuclear weapon and trigger a dangerous arms race in the Middle East. They have a lot of other criticisms. Many of them, of course, say the Iranians cannot be trusted, that they will cheat, and that they won't be caught. A lot of other concerns expressed. How do you respond to some of these major overall criticisms of the accord?
You know, there are a lot of talking points flying back and forth about what the deal doesn't do or what the deal does do. I really think this does come down to a few vested interests who prefer the status quo in the region. So for the Israelis and the Saudis, I think that this is really a concern that Iran may now be brought into the framework. Iran may now be a part of some of the conversations on how to deal with challenges in the region. And for now, I think it's a political problem in which tough decisions need to be made, not just by the Iranians, but by these other states in the region, and they prefer the status quo. They like having this relationship with the United States where, because the U.S. doesn't have any other options, we don't have any other friends in the region. It's us versus Iran and, you know, whoever's with us. We have to rubber stamp whatever the Israelis and the Saudis tell us to do. And so this potentially changes things because it gives the United States an option to begin talking to another country that is deeply involved in all of the issues that we care about.
Certainly, there's going to be a lot of debate in this country about the nuclear accord with Iran, and opponents will try to gain enough votes in Congress to override an expected presidential veto. And you recently wrote that the U.S. peace movement must mobilize now to prevent Congress from sabotaging the Iran nuclear agreement, and that action really has to start now. Tell our listeners a little bit about what you think the role of the peace movement is right now.
The peace movement is going to make or break this deal because this deal is now in the hands of Congress. And this is an opportunity to stop a war before it starts. This is, you know, it's not necessarily as sexy to be sealing a deal and supporting diplomacy, but this is the chance to put the threat of a war with Iran off the table. And for once, instead of saying every option's on the table, we actually have peace on the table.
That was Jamal Abdi, Action Executive Director with the National Iranian American Council. For more views on the Iran nuclear agreement and the fight ahead in Congress, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Recent press reports from Ukraine detail long-repeated charges that Russia's military is supplying both troops and heavy weapons to pro-Russian separatists fighting to preserve the breakaway self-proclaimed Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics in the eastern part of the country. The pro-Western government in Kiev warns that a troop buildup near the Russian-Ukraine border could signal a possible attack on the strategic city of Mariupol this summer. After U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced on June 23rd that the Pentagon will pre-position tanks, artillery, and other heavy military equipment in the Baltics and Eastern Europe, Moscow condemned the move and said they would respond by deploying more than 40 intercontinental ballistic missiles to its nuclear arsenal this year. More recently, Ukrainian and American troops launched a new joint military exercise near the Ukraine-Polish border on July 20th as a show of force to deter the perceived threat of Russian aggression. In another sign of increasing tensions between the U.S. and Russia, when Marine Corps General Joseph Dunford testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee on his nomination to become chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on July 9th, the general told lawmakers that Russia presents the greatest threat to U.S. national security and stated that he supports providing lethal arms to Ukraine's government. Your reporter spoke with Stephen F. Cohen, professor emeritus in Russian studies and politics at New York University in Princeton, who assesses the danger posed by the ongoing East-West proxy war in Ukraine and U.S.-Russian military escalation in the region that could lead to unintended consequences in this rapidly expanding new Cold War.
So as we talk, both sides are moving their troops closer and closer. NATO is conducting very large scale, what they call them exercises, operations on Russia's borders in the Baltics, Poland, and speaking of even larger ones involving thousands and thousands of men and men and women, hundreds of ships, maybe thousands of tanks and armored personnel carrier, really serious military maneuvers on Russia's borders. Meanwhile, it's certainly true that Russia has been supplying and training the rebel army in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbas. But I would ask you this question, and you don't know the answer, and I don't know the answer because they won't tell us. How many American and NATO boots on the ground are there in Ukraine at this moment? We know that there are 300 Americans. We've been told they're there training the National Guard, as they call it. The Canadians are there. The Brits are there. Others are surely there. Probably 1,500. I doubt if there are more than 1,500 Russian trainers, minders, traveling with, helping the rebel army. So it's a proxy war, and that's where the danger is. The problem is you've got completely conflicting narratives. Russia says this is a crisis brought upon Russia by the West when it moved to take Ukraine into NATO. That's what this is all about, says Russia. We say this is about Putin's aggression. And when you have such conflicting narratives, you don't get any negotiation.
Professor Stephen Cohen, as many of our listeners are aware, there are recent comments made by the next Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, who, when testifying at a hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said, "Russia presents the greatest threat to U.S. national security," as he also advocated sending U.S. lethal weapons to the pro-Western government in Ukraine. Comments that seem to escalate this burgeoning Cold War by the guy who's going to be heading up the Pentagon quite soon.
Yeah, but he's simply following the President of the United States. A month or so ago, President Obama said, both in Washington and at the United Nations, that the three gravest threats to the United States in this order were Russia, Ebola, and the Islamic State. In other words, the President of the United States is telling us that Russia is a greater threat to the United States than these guys who are chopping off heads in the Middle East and a terribly infectious virus. This came from the President. So these guys who have been nominated to be his military commanders, and it wasn't one of them. It was the new appointee to be head of the Joint Chiefs. It was the woman who's been appointed to be the head of the Air Force. And it was the new Joint Chiefs deputy, all said, and they use the same language, Russia is the number one existential threat to the United States. This is worse than malarkey. This is warmongering of the worst kind. And imagine, ask yourself, how this goes down in Moscow.
Professor Cohen, what role do you think the U.S. peace movement should be playing now before this burgeoning new Cold War gets out of control even further?
The difference is that back in the 70s and 80s, which you call the peace movement, and particularly the anti-nuke movement, had real grassroots SWAT. It actually told local candidates, talk about our issues, or we won't vote for you. And so we got the anti-nuke issue, the detente with the Soviet Union issue, into the debate. Every presidential campaign in my young adult and mid-adult lifetime, it was discussed. It's not discussed today. Now, whether that's the fact because that when the Soviet Union ended, what you call the peace movement or the anti-nuke movement decided its job was over. It thought the Cold War was over, though I was writing in the 90s, it's not over. It was only over in Moscow. It wasn't over in Washington. Now people are beginning to worry about the nuclear weapons again. You get people who study nuclear weapons, who are worried about the way both sides are talking, about tactical weapons. Both sides menacing rhetorically the other with nuclear weapons. So maybe this movement will revive itself. But at the moment, it doesn't exist in any form, large or substantive or visible enough to play a role. But today, it's the renewed American-Russian confrontation, the two nuclear powers, that's the real danger. The nuclear arms race is on again. Walter Pincus, a very esteemed writer for the Washington Post, wrote a column about this 2 or 3 weeks ago. These are very bad times, but the news hasn't seemed to have gotten out.
That was Stephen F. Cohen, professor emeritus in Russian studies and politics at New York University in Princeton. He now serves as a Nation magazine contributing editor. Find more analysis on the escalation of U.S.-Russian tensions by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Arizona's Republican Senator John McCain has been the focus of recent news headlines after GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump charged that McCain wasn't a hero for the time he spent in a North Vietnamese prison camp during the Vietnam War. That statement caused politicians from across the political spectrum to come to McCain's defense. But there's another group of people who don't consider McCain a hero. The 15,000 members of the San Carlos Apache tribe in McCain's home state of Arizona. The tribe is angry because McCain and Arizona's other Republican Senator Jeff Flake attached an 11th-hour rider to the National Defense Authorization Act last December that set up a swap of 2,400 acres of federal land called Oak Flat Campground, which is held as sacred by the Apaches. Under the terms of the land swap, Oak Flat will be traded to Resolution Copper Mining, a subsidiary of the British-Australian mining conglomerate Rio Tinto, in return for more than twice as many acres in the state owned by the company. Oak Flat is not part of the Apache Reservation, but has been set aside for their use for decades due to its cultural and religious significance. The tribe had no opportunity for meaningful input into the decision. The mining company, for its part, has promised to create thousands of jobs and generate millions of dollars in tax revenue. After holding a sacred run to Oak Flat in early July, about 80 members of the tribe traveled to Washington, D.C. during the fourth week of July to support a bill sponsored by Arizona Congressman Raul Grijalva that would reverse the land swap. Members of the tribe and their supporters organized a day of prayer followed by a lobby day on Capitol Hill. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Wenzler Nosey Sr., a tribal council member and former tribal chairman, who's participating in the caravan to Washington, D.C. He asserts that the land swap is a religious and human rights issue, and it's undermining tribal sovereignty. Nosey also warns that if the swap is allowed to stand, other tribes with federal land set-asides that are not part of their reservations could suffer the same fate.
Rider that he attached to the National Defense Bill, there is no security anymore to reservations that sit on federal land, because in this bill that passed through as a late night rider, it eliminated our voice, it eliminated our ties, it eliminated our ceremonial, and it eliminated our identity. So this is setting precedence to the future, and this is why all tribes are an opponent to this decision of John McCain, because it does affect us whether you're on the reservation or not. It applies to all federal land.
Another member of the Arizona congressional delegation, Democrat Raul Grijalva, has introduced a bill with 17 co-sponsors that would basically reverse the land swap, right?
And in the beginning, you know, and this is where I really admire the man, because of his ability, and we all have this ability, but his ability to not be afraid to realize that there was no transparency and that there was a total giveaway on the American side, and that this is the American people's responsibility to assure that what we have in America is not being lost and not being given away freely. And so with Grijalva to understand how the administrative process works on the land exchange, I have to give him prompts, because, I mean, it was so great, and knowing that you had a congressional leader who understood that why are you forfeiting these laws to a European country and a European company when you don't even afford that to your own people of America? And then the second part of that was him taking the initial time to see and understand and question and come to the area and see the holy site and the sacred site of the Apache people, and to know the important history of how it plays into the identity of who we are in our ceremonial rites, and how it would affect those yet to be born.
So this journey isn't a run or a march, but you're traveling in vehicles, right?
We started actually on Mount Graham, which is a holy and sacred site as well. And we ran about 158 miles with the staff, with the sacred items to Oak Flats. And at Oak Flats is where we had our ceremony. And then from there, we made our journey the rest of the way in our vehicles as a convoy. And the reason why was that there were so many tribes and so many organizations and church denominations were calling to see if we could stop, come by. I mean, it led us all the way to, you know, the northern part of the country, you know, up to Minneapolis, to Chicago, Philadelphia, New York. And the important thing is the fact that we need to educate. We need to show that what this bill meant to this country. But it was a great thing that we did do that so that we could meet as many as we could. And the scary part was many of the eastern coast that we met, a lot of them didn't even realize that there was an Apache tribe and that they didn't realize that the Apache people and other tribes still was in existence. We met many people that have never, ever met a Native American. And so when they got informed of the issue, they quickly became involved.
Wensler Nosy, what is your plan for your time in D.C.? What do you hope to accomplish?
People like John McCain can play and take advantage of the laws and misuse those laws. You know, we can already defeat that. I don't care who you are. There's no way when people can cheat and people can and steal and take away by using their own policies, by exempting themselves or others, you know, to it, then it's a completely undermined game that they play. So with that in place, we knew that we had to come here spiritually. We have to come here guided, and we know that touching the lands and touching the people, you know, would bring a spiritual way of healing. So that's what's going to take place on Tuesday when we finish our ceremony and our prayers. So that's what's going to take place on Tuesday. Then on Wednesday, that's where we're going to have tribal officials. We're going to have Gojava himself has committed to come and speak. And there's other congressional leaders that are invited. We also will have people speaking on their issues. Because it all comes down to the same problem as the United States Congress exempting companies, corporations, from federal laws that protect the land and protect the interests of this country.
That was Wensler Nosy Sr. of the San Carlos Apache Tribe. Learn more about the tribe's campaign to reverse the Oak Flat land grab by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.